our century, galvanized second modernity populations around the world. New companies such as Google and Facebook appeared to bring the promise of the inversion to life in new domains of critical importance, rescuing information and people from the old institutional confines, enabling us to find what and whom we wanted, when and how we wanted to search or connect. The Apple inversion implied trustworthy relationships of advocacy and reciprocity embedded in an alignment of commercial operations with consumers' genuine interests. It held out the promise of a new digital market form that might transcend the collision. An early intimation of a third modernity capitalism summoned by the self-determining aspirations of individuals and indigenous to the digital milieu. The opportunity for my life, my way at a price I can afford was the human promise that quickly lodged at the very heart of the commercial digital project. From iPhones to one-click ordering to massive open online courses to on-demand services to hundreds of thousands of web-based enterprises, apps, and devices. There were missteps, shortfalls, and vulnerabilities, to be sure. The potential significance of Apple's tacit new logic was never fully grasped, even by the company itself. Instead, the corporation produced a steady stream of contradictions that signaled business as usual. Apple was criticized for extractive pricing policies, offshoring jobs, exploiting its retail staff, abrogating responsibility for factory conditions, colluding to depress wages via illicit non-compete agreements in employee recruitment, institutionalized tax evasion, and lack of environmental stewardship, just to name a few of the violations that seemed to negate the implicit social contract of its own unique logic. When it comes to genuine economic mutation, there is always a tension between the new features of the form and its mothership. A combination of old and new is reconfigured in an unprecedented pattern. Occasionally, the elements of a mutation find the right environment in which to be selected for propagation. This is when the new form stands a chance of becoming fully institutionalized and establishes its unique migratory path toward the future. But it's even more likely that potential mutations meet their fate in transition failure, drawn back by the gravitational pull of established practices. Was the Apple inversion a powerful new economic mutation, running the gauntlet of trial and error on its way to fulfilling the needs of a new age? Or was it a case of transition failure? In our enthusiasm and growing dependency on technology, we tend to forget that the same forces of capital from which we had fled in the real world were rapidly claiming ownership of the wider digital sphere. This left us vulnerable and caught unawares when the early promise of information capitalism took a darker turn. We celebrated the promise of help is on the way, while troubling questions broke through the haze with increasing regularity, each one followed by a predictable eruption of dismay and anger. Why did Google's Gmail, launched in 2004, scan private correspondence to generate advertising? As soon as the first Gmail user saw the first ad targeted to the content of her private correspondence, public reaction was swift. Many were repelled and outraged. Others were confused. As Google chronicler Stephen Levy put it, by serving ads related to content, Google seemed almost to be reveling in the fact that users' privacy was at the mercy of the policies and trustworthiness of the company that owned the servers. And since those ads made profits, Google was making it clear that it would exploit the situation. In 2007, Facebook launched Beacon, touting it as a new way to socially distribute information. Beacon enabled Facebook advertisers to track users across the internet, disclosing users' purchases to their personal networks without permission. Most people were outraged by the company's audacity, both in tracking them online and in usurping their ability to control the disclosure of their own facts. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg shut the program down under duress, but by 2010, He declared that privacy was no longer a social norm, and then congratulated himself for relaxing the company's privacy policies to reflect this self-interested assertion of a new social condition. Zuckerberg had apparently never read user Jonathan Trenn's rendering of his beacon experience. I purchased a diamond engagement ring set from Overstock in preparation for a New Year's surprise for my girlfriend. Within hours, I received a shocking call from one of my best friends of surprise and congratulations for getting engaged. 3! Imagine my horror when I learned that Overstock had published the details of my purchase, including a link to the item and its price, on my public Facebook news feed, as well as notifications to all of my friends. All of my friends, including my girlfriend, and all of her friends, etc. All of this was without my consent or knowledge. I am totally distressed that my surprise was ruined, and what was meant to be something special and a lifetime memory for my girlfriend and I was destroyed by a totally underhanded and infuriating privacy invasion. I want to wring the neck of the folks at Overstock and Facebook who thought that this was a good idea. It sets a terrible precedent on the net, and I feel that it ruined a part of my life. Among the many violations of advocacy expectations, ubiquitous terms of service agreements were among the most pernicious. Legal experts call these contracts of adhesion because they impose take-it-or-leave-it conditions on users that stick to them whether they like it or not. Online contracts, such as terms of service or terms of use agreements, are also referred to as click wrap, because, as a great deal of research shows, most people get wrapped in these oppressive contract terms by simply clicking on the box that says, "I agree," without ever reading the agreement. In many cases, simply browsing a website obligates you to its terms of service agreement, even if you don't know it. Scholars point out that these digital documents are excessively long and complex, in part to discourage users from actually reading the terms. Safe in the knowledge that most courts have upheld the legitimacy of click-wrap agreements, despite the obvious lack of meaningful consent. U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts admitted that he doesn't read the computer fine print. Adding insult to injury, terms of service can be altered unilaterally by the firm at any time without specific user knowledge or consent, and the terms typically implicate other companies, partners, suppliers, marketers, advertising intermediaries, etc., without stating or accepting responsibility for their terms of service. These contracts impose an unwinnable, infinite regress upon the user that law professor Nancy Kim describes as sadistic. Legal scholar Margaret Radin observes the Alice in Wonderland quality of such contracts. Indeed, the sacred notions of agreement and promise, so critical to the evolution of the institution of contract since Roman times, have developed to a talismanic signal, merely indicating that the firm deploying the boilerplate wants the recipient to be bound. Radin calls this private eminent domain a unilateral seizure of rights without consent. She regards such contracts as a moral and democratic degradation of the rule of law and the institution of contract, a perversion that restructures the rights of users granted through democratic processes, substituting for them the system that the firm wishes to impose. Recipients must enter a legal universe of the firm's devising in order to engage in transactions with the firm. The digital milieu has been essential to these degradations. Kim points out that paper documents once imposed natural restraints on contracting behavior simply by virtue of their cost to produce, distribute, and archive. Paper contracts require a physical signature, limiting the burden a firm is likely to impose on a customer by requiring her to read multiple pages of fine print. Digital terms, in contrast, are weightless. They can be expanded, reproduced, distributed, and archived at no additional cost. Once firms understood that the courts were disposed to validate their click-wrap and browse-wrap agreements, There was nothing to stop them from expanding the reach of these degraded contracts to extract from consumers additional benefits unrelated to the transaction. This coincided with the discovery of behavioral surplus that we examine in Chapter 3, as terms of service agreements were extended to include baroque and perverse privacy policies, establishing another infinite regress of these terms of expropriation. Even the former Federal Trade Commission chairperson John Leibowitz publicly stated, "We all agree that consumers don't read privacy policies." In 2008, two Carnegie Mellon professors calculated that a reasonable reading of all the privacy policies that one encounters in a year would require 76 full workdays at a national opportunity cost of $781 billion. The numbers are much higher today. Still, most users remain unaware of these rapacious terms that, as Kim puts it, allows firms to acquire rights without bargaining and to stealthily establish and embed practices before users and regulators realize what has happened. At first, it had seemed that the new internet companies had simply failed to grasp the moral, social, and institutional requirements of their own economic logic. But with each corporate transgression, it became more difficult to ignore the possibility that the pattern of violations signaled a feature, not a bug. Although the Apple miracle contained the seeds of economic reformation, it was poorly understood, a mystery even to itself. Long before the death of its legendary founder, Steve Jobs, its frequent abuses of user expectations raised questions about how well the corporation understood the deep structure and historic potential of its own creations. The dramatic success of Apple's iPod and iTunes instilled internet users with a sense of optimism toward the new digital capitalism. But Apple never did seize the reins on developing the consistent, comprehensive social and institutional processes that would have elevated the iPod's promise to an explicit market form, as Henry Ford and Alfred Sloan had once done. These developments reflect the simple truth that genuine economic reformation takes time, and that the internet world, its investors and shareholders, were and are in a hurry. The credo of digital innovation quickly turned to the language of disruption and an obsession with speed, its campaigns conducted under the flag of creative destruction. That famous, fateful phrase coined by evolutionary economist Joseph Schumpeter was seized upon as a way to legitimate what Silicon Valley euphemistically calls permissionless innovation. Destruction rhetoric promoted what I think of as a boys and their toys theory of history, as if the winning hand in capitalism is about blowing things up with new technologies. Schumpeter's analysis was, in fact, far more nuanced and complex than modern destruction rhetoric suggests. Although Schumpeter regarded capitalism as an evolutionary process, he also considered that relatively few of its continuous innovations actually rise to the level of evolutionary significance. These rare events are what he called mutations. These are enduring, sustainable, qualitative shifts in the logic, understanding, and practice of capitalist accumulation, not random, temporary, or opportunistic reactions to circumstances. Schumpeter insisted that this evolutionary mechanism is triggered by new consumer needs, and alignment with those needs is the discipline that drives sustainable mutation. The capitalist process, not by coincidence but by virtue of its mechanism, progressively raises the standard of life of the masses. If a mutation is to be reliably sustained, its new aims and practices must be translated into new institutional forms. The fundamental impulse that sets and keeps the capitalist engine in motion comes from the new consumers' goods, the new methods of production or transportation, the new markets, the new forms of industrial organization that capitalist enterprise creates. Note that Schumpeter says, creates, not destroys. As an example of mutation, Schumpeter cites, The stages of organizational development from the craft shop to the factory to a complex corporation like U.S. Steel. Schumpeter understood creative destruction as one unfortunate byproduct of a long and complex process of creative sustainable change. Capitalism, he wrote, creates and destroys. Schumpeter was adamant on this point. Creative response shapes the whole course of subsequent events and their long-run outcome. Creative response changes social and economic situations for good. This is why creative response is an essential element in the historical process. No deterministic credo avails against this. Finally, and contrary to the rhetoric of Silicon Valley and its worship of speed, Schumpeter argued that genuine mutation demands patience. We are dealing with a process whose every element takes considerable time in revealing its true features and ultimate effects. We must judge its performance over time as it unfolds through decades or centuries. The significance of a mutation in Schumpeter's reckoning implies a high threshold, one that is crossed in time through the serious work of inventing new institutional forms embedded in the new needs of new people. Relatively little destruction is creative, especially in the absence of a robust double movement. This is illustrated in Schumpeter's example of U.S. Steel, founded by some of the Gilded Age's most notorious robber barons, including Andrew Carnegie and J.P. Morgan. Under pressure from an increasingly insistent double movement, U.S. Steel eventually institutionalized fair labor practices through unions and collective bargaining, as well as internal labor markets, career ladders, professional hierarchies, employment security, training, and development, all while implementing its technological advances in mass production. Mutation is not a fairy tale. It is rational capitalism, bound in reciprocities with its populations through democratic institutions. Mutations fundamentally change the nature of capitalism by shifting it in the direction of those it is supposed to serve. This source of thinking is not nearly as sexy or exciting as the boys and their toys gambit would have us think, but this is what it will take to move the dial of economic history beyond the collision and toward modernity. 6. Surveillance capitalism fills the void. A new breed of economic power swiftly filled the void in which every casual search, like, and click was claimed as an asset to be tracked, parsed, and monetized by some company, all within a decade of the iPod's debut. It was as if a shark had been silently circling the depths all along, just below the surface of the action, only to occasionally leap glistening from the water in pursuit of a fresh bite of flesh. Eventually, companies began to explain these violations as the necessary quid pro quo for free internet services. Privacy, they said, was the price one must pay for the abundant rewards of information, connection, and other digital goods when, where, and how you want them. These explanations distracted us from the sea change that would rewrite the rules of capitalism and the digital world. In retrospect, we can see that the many discordant challenges to users' expectations were actually tiny peepholes into a rapidly emerging institutional form that was learning to exploit second modernity needs and the established norms of growth through exclusion as the means to an utterly novel market project. Over time, the shark revealed itself as a rapidly multiplying, systemic, internally consistent new variant of information capitalism that had set its sights on domination. An unprecedented formulation of capitalism was elbowing its way into history. Surveillance capitalism. This new market form is a unique logic of accumulation in which surveillance is a foundational mechanism in the transformation of investment into profit. Its rapid rise, institutional elaboration, and significant expansion challenged the tentative promise of the inversion and its advocacy-oriented values. More generally, the rise of surveillance capitalism betrayed the hopes and expectations of many netizens who cherished the emancipatory promise of the networked milieu. Surveillance capitalism commandeered the wonders of the digital world to meet our needs for effective life, promising the magic of unlimited information and a thousand ways to anticipate our needs and ease the complexities of our harried lives. We welcomed it into our hearts and homes with our own rituals of hospitality. As we shall explore in detail throughout the coming chapters, thanks to surveillance capitalism, the resources for effective life that we seek in the digital realm now come encumbered with a new breed of menace. Under this new regime, the precise moment at which our needs are met is also the precise moment at which our lives are plundered for behavioral data, and all for the sake of others' gain. The result is a perverse amalgam of empowerment, inextricably layered with diminishment. In the absence of a decisive societal response that constrains or outlaws this logic of accumulation, surveillance capitalism appears poised to become the dominant form of capitalism in our time. How did this happen? It is a question that we shall return to throughout this book as we accumulate new insights and answers. For now, we can recognize that over the centuries we have imagined threat in the form of state power. This left us wholly unprepared to defend ourselves from new companies with imaginative names run by young geniuses that seemed able to provide us with exactly what we yearn for at little or no cost. This new regime's most poignant harms, now and later, have been difficult to grasp or theorize, blurred by extreme velocity and camouflaged by expensive and illegible machine operations, secretive corporate practices, masterful rhetorical misdirection, and purposeful cultural misappropriation. On this road, terms whose meanings we take to be positive, or at least banal, the open internet, interoperability, and connectivity, have been quietly harnessed to a market process in which individuals are definitively cast as the means to others' market ends. Surveillance capitalism has taken root so quickly that, with the exception of a courageous cadre of legal scholars and technology-savvy activists, it has cunningly managed to evade our understanding and agreement. As we will discuss in more depth in Chapter 4, surveillance capitalism is inconceivable outside the digital milieu. But neoliberal ideology and policy also provided the habitat in which surveillance capitalism could flourish. This ideology and its practical implementation bends second modernity individuals to the draconian quid pro quo at the heart of surveillance capitalism's logic of accumulation, in which information and connection are ransomed for the lucrative behavioral data that fund its immense growth and profits. Any effort to interrupt or dismantle surveillance capitalism will have to contend with this larger institutional landscape that protects and sustains its operations. History offers no control groups, and we cannot say whether with different leadership, more time, or other altered circumstances, Apple might have perceived, elaborated, and institutionalized the jewel in its crown, as Henry Ford and Alfred Sloan had done in another era. Nor is that opportunity forever lost. Far from it. We may yet see the founding of a new synthesis for a third modernity, in which a genuine inversion and its social compact are institutionalized as principles of a new rational digital capitalism, aligned with a society of individuals and supported by democratic institutions. The fact that Schumpeter reckoned the timeline for such institutionalization in decades or even centuries lingers as a critical commentary on our larger story. These developments are all the more dangerous because they cannot be reduced to known harms, monopoly, privacy, and therefore do not easily yield to known forms of combat. The new harms we face entail challenges to the sanctity of the individual, and chief among these challenges I count the elemental rights that bear on individual sovereignty, including the right to the future tense and the right to sanctuary. Each of these rights invokes claims to individual agency and personal autonomy as essential prerequisites to freedom of will and to the very concept of democratic order. Right now, however, the extreme asymmetries of knowledge and power that have accrued to surveillance capitalism abrogate these elemental rights as our lives are unilaterally rendered as data, expropriated and repurposed in new forms of social control, all of it in the service of others' interests and in the absence of our awareness or means of combat. We have yet to invent the politics and new forms of collaborative action, this century's equivalent of the social movements of the late 19th and 20th centuries that aimed to tether raw capitalism to society, that effectively assert the people's right to a human future. And while the work of these inventions awaits us, this mobilization and the resistance it engenders will define a key battleground upon which the fight for a human future unfolds. On August 9, 2011, events ricocheted between two wildly different visions of a third modernity. One was based on the digital promise of democratized information in the context of individualized economic and social relations. The other reflected the harsh truths of mass exclusion and elite rule. But the lessons of that day had not yet been fully tallied when fresh answers, or more modestly, the tenuous glimmers of answers as fragile as a newborn's translucent skin, rose to the surface of the world's attention, gliding on scented ribbons of Spanish lavender and vanilla. 7. For a Human Future. In the wee hours of August 9, 2011, 18-year-old Maria Elena Montes sat on the cool marble floor of her family's century-old pastry shop in the El Raval section of Barcelona, nursing her cup of sweet café con leche, lulled by the sunrise scuffling of the pigeons in the plaza as she waited for her trays of rum-soaked gypsy cakes to set. Pastelería La Dulce occupied a cramped medieval building, tucked into a tiny square on one of the few streets that had escaped both the wrecking ball and the influx of yuppie chic. The Montes family took care that the passing decades had no visible effect on their cherished bakery. Each morning they lovingly filled sparkling glass cases with crispy, sugar-studded churros, delicate buñuelos fat with vanilla custard, tiny paper ramekins of strawberry flan, buttery mantecados, coiled ensaimadas drenched in powdered sugar, fluffy magdalenas, crunchy pestiños, and great-grandmother Montes's special flao, a cake made with fresh milk cheese laced with Spanish lavender, fennel, and mint. There were almond and blood orange tarts prepared, according to Señora Montes, exactly as they had once been served to Queen Isabella. Olive oil ice cream, flavored with anise, filled the tubs in the gleaming white freezer along the wall. An old ceiling fan cycled slowly, nudging the perfume of honey and yeast into every corner of the ageless room. Only one thing had changed. Any other August would have found Maria Elena and her family at their summer cottage, nestled into a pine grove near the seaside town of Palafrugell, that had been the family's refuge for generations. In 2011, however, neither the Montes nor their customers and friends would take their August holidays. The economic crisis had ripped through the country like the Black Plague, shrinking consumption and driving unemployment to 21%, the highest in the EU, and to an astonishing 46% among people under 24 years old. In Catalonia, the region that includes Barcelona, 18% of its 7.5 million people had fallen below the poverty line. In the summer of 2011, few could afford the simple pleasure of an August spent by the sea or in the mountains. There was new pressure to sell the building and let the future finally swallow La Dulce. The family could live comfortably on the proceeds of such a sale, even at the bargain rates they would be forced to accept. Business was slow, but Señor Fito Montes refused to lay off any members of a staff that was like an extended family after years of steady employment. Just about everyone they knew said that the end was inevitable and that the Montes should leap at the opportunity for a dignified exit. But the family was determined to make every sacrifice to safeguard Pastelería La Dulce for the future. Just 3 months earlier, Juan Pablo and Maria had made the pilgrimage to Madrid to join thousands of protesters at the Puerta del Sol, where a month-long encampment established Los Indignados, the 15M, as the new voice of a people who had finally been pushed to the breaking point by the economics of contempt. All that was left to say was, ya, no más. Enough already. The convergence of so many citizens in Madrid led to a wave of protests across the nation, and eventually those protests would give way to new political parties, including Podemos. Neighborhood assemblies had begun to convene in many cities, and the Montes had attended such a meeting in El Raval just the night before. With the evening's conversation still fresh, they gathered in the apartment above the shop in the early afternoon of August 9th to share their midday meal and discuss the fate of La Dulce, not quite certain what Papa Montes was thinking. The bankers may not know it, Fito Montes reflected, but the future will need the past. It will need these marble floors and the sweet taste of my gypsy cakes. They treat us like figures in a ledger, like they are reading the number of casualties in a plane crash. They believe the future belongs only to them. But we each have our story. We each have our life. It is up to us to proclaim our right to the future. The future is our home, too. Maria and Juan Pablo breathed a shared sigh of relief as they outlined their plan. Juan Pablo would withdraw temporarily from his university studies, and Maria Elena would postpone her matriculation. They would work on expanding La Dulce's sales with new home delivery and catering options. Everyone would take a pay cut, but no one would have to leave. Everyone would tighten their belts, except the fat Buñuelos and their perfect comrades steadfast in neat, delicious rows. "We know how to challenge the inevitable," they said. "We've survived wars. We've survived the fascists. We'll survive again." For Fito Montes, his family's right to anticipate the future as their home demanded continuity for some things that are elusive, beautiful, surprising, mysterious, inexpressible, and immaterial, but without which, they all agreed, life would be mechanical and soulless. He was determined, for example, to ensure that another generation of Spanish children would recognize the bouquet of his blood-orange tarts flecked with rose petals, and thus be awakened to the mystery of medieval life in the fragrant gardens of the Alhambra. On August 9th, the heat rose steadily in the shady square, and the sun emptied the avenues where Huns, Moors, Castilians, and Bourbons had each in their turn marched to triumph. Those silent streets bore little evidence of the historic deliberations in Madrid that would be featured in the New York Times that very day. But I imagine the two cities linked by invisible ribbons of scent, rising from La Dulce high into the bleached Barcelona sky, and drifting slowly south and west to settle along the austere facade of the building that housed the Agencia Española de Protección de Datos, where another struggle for the right to the future tense was underway. The Spanish Data Protection Agency had chosen to champion the claims of 90 ordinary citizens who, like the Montes family, were determined to preserve inherited meaning for a world bent on change at the speed of light. In the name of the right to be forgotten, the Spaniards had stepped into the bullring, brandishing red capes, resolved to master the fiercest bull of all, Google, the juggernaut of surveillance capitalism. When the agency ordered the internet firm to stop indexing the contested links of these 90 individuals, the bull received one of its first and most significant blows. This official confrontation drew upon the same tenacity, determination, and sentiment that sustained the Montez family and millions of other Spaniards compelled to claw back the future from the self-proclaimed inevitability of indifferent capital. In the assertion of a right to be forgotten, the complexity of human existence, with its thousand million shades of gray, was pitted against surveillance capitalism's economic imperatives that produced the relentless drive to extract and retain information. It was there, in Spain, that the right to the future tense was on the move, insisting that the operations of surveillance capitalism and its digital architecture are not, never were, and never would be inevitable. Instead, the opposition asserted that even Google's capitalism was made by humans to be unmade and remade by democratic processes, not commercial decree. Google's was not to be the last word on the human or the digital future. Each of the 90 citizens had a unique claim. One had been terrorized by her former husband and didn't want him to find her address online. Informational privacy was essential to her peace of mind and her physical safety. A middle-aged woman was embarrassed by an old arrest from her days as a university student. Informational privacy was essential to her identity and sense of dignity. One was an attorney, Mario Costeja Gonzalez, who years earlier had suffered the foreclosure of his home. Although the matter had long been resolved, a Google search of his name continued to deliver links to the foreclosure notice, which, he argued, damaged his reputation. While the Spanish Data Protection Agency rejected the idea of requiring newspapers and other originating sites to remove legitimate information, such information, they reasoned, would exist somewhere under any circumstances. It endorsed the notion that Google had responsibility and should be held to account. After all, Google had unilaterally undertaken to change the rules of the information life cycle when it decided to crawl, index, and make accessible personal details across the World Wide Web without asking anyone's permission. The agency concluded that citizens had the right to request the removal of links and ordered Google to stop indexing the information and to remove existing links to its original sources. Google's mission to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful, starting with the web, changed all of our lives. There have been enormous benefits, to be sure. But for individuals, it has meant that information that would normally age and be forgotten now remains forever young, highlighted in the foreground of each person's digital identity. The Spanish Data Protection Agency recognized that not all information is worthy of immortality. Some information should be forgotten because that is only human. Unsurprisingly, Google challenged the agency's order before the Spanish High Court, which selected one of the 90 cases, that of attorney Mario Costeja Gonzalez, for referral to the Court of Justice of the European Union. There, after lengthy and dramatic deliberations, the Court of Justice announced its decision to assert the right to be forgotten as a fundamental principle of EU law in May of 2014. The Court of Justice's decision, so often reduced to the legal and technical considerations related to the deletion or de-linking of personal data, was in fact a key inflection point at which democracy began to claw back rights to the future tense from the powerful forces of a new surveillance capitalism determined to claim unilateral authority over the digital future. Instead, the court's analysis claimed the future for the human way, rejecting the inevitability of Google's search engine technology, and recognizing instead that search results are the contingent products of the specified economic interests that drive the action from within the belly of the machine. The operator of a search engine is liable to affect significantly the fundamental rights to privacy and to the protection of personal data. In the light of the potential seriousness of the interference with those interests, it cannot be justified by merely the economic interest which the operator of such an engine has in that processing. As legal scholars Paul M. Schwartz and Carl Nicholas Pfeiffer summarized it, the Luxembourg court felt that free flow of information matters, but not as much, ultimately, as the safeguarding of dignity, privacy, and data protection in the European rights regime. The court conferred upon EU citizens the right to combat, requiring Google to establish a process for implementing users' de-linking requests and authorizing citizens to seek recourse in democratic institutions, including the supervisory authority or the judicial authority, so that it carries out the necessary checks and orders the controller to take specific measures accordingly. In reasserting the right to be forgotten, the court declared that decisive authority over the digital future rests with the people, their laws, and their democratic institutions. It affirmed that individuals and democratic societies can fight for their rights to the future tense and can win, even in the face of a great private power. As the human rights scholar Federico Fabbrini observed, with this vital case, the European Court of Justice evolved more assertively into the role of a human rights court, stepping into the minefield of human rights in the digital age. When the Court of Justice's decision was announced, the smart money said that it could never happen in the U.S., where the internet companies typically seek cover behind the First Amendment as justification for their permissionless innovation. Some technology observers called the ruling nuts. Google's leaders sneered at the decision. Reporters characterized Google co-founder Sergey Brin as joking and dismissive. When asked about the ruling during a Q&A at a prominent tech conference, he said, "I wish we could just forget the ruling." In response to the ruling, Google CEO and co-founder Larry Page recited the catechism of the firm's mission statement, assuring the Financial Times that the company still aims to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. Page defended Google's unprecedented information power with an extraordinary statement suggesting that people should trust Google more than democratic institutions. In general, having the data present in companies like Google is better than having it in the government with no due process to get that data, because we obviously care about our reputation. I'm not sure the government cares about that as much. Speaking to the company's shareholders the day after the court's ruling, Eric Schmidt characterized the decision as a balance that was struck wrong in the collision between a right to be forgotten and a right to know. The comments of Google's leaders reflected their determination to retain privileged control over the future and their indignation at being challenged. However, there was ample evidence that the American public did not concede the corporation's unilateral power. In fact, the smart money appeared not to be all that smart. In the year following the EU decision, a national poll of U.S. adults found that 88% supported a law similar to the right to be forgotten. That year, Pew Research found that 93% of Americans believed that it was important to have control of who can get information about you. A series of polls echoed these findings. On January 1, 2015, California's online eraser law took effect, requiring the operator of a website, online service, online application, or mobile application to permit a minor who is a registered user of the operator's service to remove or to request and obtain removal of content or information posted by the minor. The California law breached a critical surveillance embattlement, attenuating Google's role as the self-proclaimed champion of an unbounded right to know, and suggesting that we are still at the beginning, not the end, of a long and fitful drama. The Spanish Data Protection Agency, and later the European Court of Justice, demonstrated the unbearable lightness of the inevitable, as both institutions declared what is at stake for a human future, beginning with the primacy of democratic institutions in shaping a healthy and just digital future. The smart money says that U.S. law will never abandon its allegiance to the surveillance capitalists over the people, But the next decades may once again prove that the smart money can be wrong. As for the Spanish people, their data protection agency, and the European Court of Justice, the passage of time is likely to reveal their achievements as a stirring early chapter in the longer story of our fight for a third modern that is first and foremost a human future, rooted in an inclusive democracy and committed to the individual's right to effective life. Their message is carefully inscribed for our children to ponder. Technological inevitability is as light as democracy is heavy, as temporary as the scent of rose petals and the taste of honey are enduring. 8. Naming and Taming. Taming surveillance capitalism must begin with careful naming, a symbiosis that was vividly illustrated in the recent history of HIV research, and I offer it as an analogy. For 3 decades, scientists aimed to create a vaccine that followed the logic of earlier cures, training the immune system to produce neutralizing antibodies. But mounting data revealed unanticipated behaviors of the HIV virus that defy the patterns of other infectious diseases. The tide began to turn at the International AIDS Conference in 2012, when new strategies were presented that rely on a close understanding of the biology of rare HIV carriers whose blood produces natural antibodies. Research began to shift toward methods that reproduce this self-vaccinating response. As a leading researcher announced, "We know the face of the enemy now, and so we have some real clues about how to approach the problem." The point for us is that every successful vaccine begins with a close understanding of the enemy disease. The mental models, vocabularies, and tools distilled from past catastrophes obstruct progress. We smell smoke and rush to close doors to rooms that are already fated to vanish. The result is like hurling snowballs at a smooth marble wall, only to watch them slide down its facade, leaving nothing but a wet smear. A fine paid here, an operational detour there, a new encryption package there. What is crucial now is that we identify this new form of capitalism on its own terms and in its own words. This pursuit necessarily returns us to Silicon Valley, where things move so fast that few people know what just happened. It is the habitat for progress at the speed of dreams, as one Google engineer vividly describes it. My aim here is to slow down the action in order to enlarge the space for such debate and unmask the tendencies of these new creations as they amplify inequality, intensify social hierarchy, exacerbate exclusion, usurp rights, and strip personal life of whatever it is that makes it personal for you or for me. If the digital future is to be our home, then it is we who must make it so. We will need to know. We will need to decide. We will need to decide who decides. This is our fight for a human future. Chapter 3. The Discovery of Behavioral Surplus. He watched the stars and noted birds in flight. A river flooded or a fortress fell. He made predictions that were sometimes right. His lucky guesses were rewarded well. W. H. Auden, Sonnets from China, 6. 1. Google, the pioneer of surveillance capitalism. Google is to surveillance capitalism what the Ford Motor Company and General Motors were to mass production-based managerial capitalism. New economic logics and their commercial models are discovered by people in a time and place, and then perfected through trial and error. In our time, Google became the pioneer, discoverer, elaborator, experimenter, lead practitioner, role model, and diffusion hub of surveillance capitalism. GM and Ford's iconic status as pioneers of 20th century capitalism made them enduring objects of scholarly research and public fascination because the lessons they had to teach resonated far beyond the individual companies. Google's practices deserve the same kind of examination, not merely as a critique of a single company, but rather as the starting point for the codification of a powerful new form of capitalism. With the triumph of mass production at Ford, and for decades thereafter, hundreds of researchers, business people, engineers, journalists, and scholars would excavate the circumstances of its invention, origins, and consequences. Decades later, scholars continued to write extensively about Ford, the man and the company. GM has also been an object of intense scrutiny. It was the site of Peter Drucker's field studies for his seminal Concept of the Corporation, the 1946 book that codified the practices of the 20th century business organization and established Drucker's reputation as a management sage. In addition to the many works of scholarship and analysis on these two firms, their own leaders enthusiastically articulated their discoveries and practices. Henry Ford and his general manager, James Cousins, and Alfred Sloan and his marketing man, Henry Buck Weaver, reflected on, conceptualized, and proselytized their achievements, specifically locating them in the evolutionary drama of American capitalism. Google is a notoriously secretive company, and one is hard-pressed to imagine a Drucker equivalent freely roaming the scene and scribbling in the hallways. Its executives carefully craft their messages of digital evangelism in books and blog posts, but its operations are not easily accessible to outside researchers or journalists. In 2016, a lawsuit brought against the company by a product manager alleged an internal spying program in which employees are expected to identify co-workers who violate the firm's confidentiality agreement, a broad prohibition against divulging anything about the company to anyone. The closest thing we have to a Buck Weaver or James Cousins codifying Google's practices and objectives is the company's longtime chief economist, Hal Varian, who aids the cause of understanding with scholarly articles that explore important themes. Varian has been described as the Adam Smith of the discipline of Googlenomics and the godfather of its advertising model. It is in Varian's work that we find, hidden in plain sight, important clues to the logic of surveillance capitalism and its claims to power. In two extraordinary articles in scholarly journals, Varian explored the theme of computer-mediated transactions and their transformational effects on the modern economy. Both pieces are written in amiable, down-to-earth prose, but Varian's casual understatement stands in counterpoint to his often startling declarations. Nowadays, there is a computer in the middle of virtually every transaction. Now that they are available, these computers have several other uses. He then identifies four such new uses: data extraction and analysis, new contractual forms due to better monitoring, personalization and customization, and continuous experiments. Varian's discussions of these new uses are an unexpected guide to the strange logic of surveillance capitalism, the division of learning that it shapes, and the character of the information civilization toward which it leads. We will return to Varian's observations from time to time in the course of our examination of the foundations of surveillance capitalism, aided by a kind of reverse engineering of his assertions, so that we might grasp the worldview and methods of surveillance capitalism through this lens. Data extraction and analysis, Varian writes, is what everyone is talking about when they talk about big data. Data are the raw material necessary for surveillance capitalism's novel manufacturing processes. Extraction describes the social relations and material infrastructure with which the firm asserts authority over those raw materials to achieve economies of scale in its raw material supply operations. Analysis refers to the complex of highly specialized computational systems that I will generally refer to in these chapters as machine intelligence. I like this umbrella phrase because it trains us on the forest rather than the trees, helping us decenter from technology to its objectives. But in choosing this phrase, I also follow Google's lead. The company describes itself at the forefront of innovation in machine intelligence, a term in which it includes machine learning as well as classical algorithmic production, along with many computational operations that are often referred to with other terms such as predictive analytics or artificial intelligence. Among these operations, Google cites its work on language translation, speed recognition, visual processing, ranking, statistical modeling, and prediction. In all of those tasks and many others, we gather large volumes of direct or indirect evidence of relationships of interest, applying learning algorithms to understand and generalize. These machine intelligence operations convert raw material into the firm's highly profitable algorithmic products designed to predict the behavior of its users. The inscrutability and exclusivity of these techniques and operations are the moat that surrounds the castle and secures the action within. Google's invention of targeted advertising paved the way to financial success, but it also laid the cornerstone of a more far-reaching development, the discovery and elaboration of surveillance capitalism. Its business is characterized as an advertising model, and much has been written about Google's automated auction methods and other aspects of its inventions in the field of online advertising. With so much verbiage, these developments are both over-described and under-theorized. Our aim in this chapter, and those that follow in Part 1, is to reveal the laws of motion that drive surveillance competition, and in order to do this, we begin by looking freshly at the point of origin, when the foundational mechanisms of surveillance capitalism were first discovered. Before we begin, I want to say a word about vocabulary. Any confrontation with the unprecedented requires new language, and I introduce new terms when existing language fails to capture a new phenomenon. Sometimes, however, I intentionally repurpose familiar language because I want to stress certain continuities in the function of an element or process. This is the case with laws of motion, borrowed from Newton's law of inertia, force, and equal and opposite reactions. Over the years, historians have adopted this term to describe the laws of industrial capitalism. For example, economic historian Ellen Makesens Wood documents the origins of capitalism in the changing relations between English property owners and tenant farmers, as the owners began to favor productivity over coercion. The new historical dynamic allows us to speak of agrarian capitalism in early modern England, a social form with distinctive laws of motion that would eventually give rise to capitalism in its mature industrial form. Wood describes how these new laws of motion eventually manifested themselves in industrial production. The critical factor in the divergence of capitalism from all other forms of commercial society was the development of certain social property relations that generated market imperatives and capitalist laws of motion, competitive production and profit maximization, the compulsion to reinvest surpluses, and the relentless need to improve labor productivity associated with capitalism. Those laws of motion required vast social transformations and upheavals to set them in train. They required a transformation in the human metabolism with nature, in the provision of life's basic necessities. My argument here is that although surveillance capitalism does not abandon established capitalist laws, such as competitive production, profit maximization, productivity, and growth, these earlier dynamics now operate in the context of a new logic of accumulation that also introduces its own distinctive laws of motion. Here and in following chapters, we will examine these foundational dynamics, including surveillance capitalism's idiosyncratic economic imperatives, defined by extraction and prediction, its unique approach to economies of scale and scope in raw material supply, its necessary construction and elaboration of means of behavioral modification that incorporate its machine intelligence-based means of production in a more complex system of action, and the ways in which the requirements of behavioral modification orient all operations toward totalities of information and control, creating the framework for an unprecedented instrumentarian power and its societal implications. For now, My aim is to reconstruct our appreciation of familiar ground through new lenses. Google's early days of optimism, crisis, and invention. 2. A balance of power. Google was incorporated in 1998,